The Athletic.
Shearer. It's a good jump. It's Kieran Dyer. Cross Ben Wondren. Oh, Dyer block. Bellamy. It's in. Oh, it's extraordinary.
Hello and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your go-to Newcastle United podcast brought to you by The Athletic. My name is Taylor Payne and coming up this week, we'll be reacting to the last gasp 1-1 draw v Aston Villa. We're going to be speaking to the author of a brand new book all about Sir Bobby Robson. Harry DeCosimo will be here to talk about Black and White Night. We'll look back at United's 2002-03 Champions League run in the archive. And Chris is asking the questions in a special Sir Bobby Robson-themed version of the quiz, where I shall pit my wits against the man who ghost-wrote Sir Bobby Robson's book. And I'm not sure that that is entirely fair, but we shall get onto that later on. Before we get into all the nonsense, I've got just enough time to remind you of the latest offer from The Athletic. So right now, you can subscribe to The Athletic for a special price of $3.99 a month for 6 months. That's 40% off the full price of a subscription. You'll enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as all the ad-free versions of the podcasts. Chris, George, hello, chaps. How are you doing? Are you well?
Yes, I'm all right, thank you. How about yourself?
I'm not too bad at all. How are you, George? Are you doing okay, mate?
I'm all right, yeah. I'm okay.
Good, good. It's been a funny old week, hasn't it? As it always is in Newcastle United land. We had the 1-1 against Villa and all the fallout that came with that. But have you guys got any articles at the minute that are out on the website or anything that the listeners and the readers should keep an eye out for?
Well, by the time this podcast is out, there should also be a piece about Matty Longstaff and where the heck he is and what's happening with him, which I've sort of written, sort of column-y piece, just looking about the situation that he's only made 5 appearances all season, hasn't been seen in a Newcastle shirt since January, is fit, but for whatever reason, isn't playing. So trying to explain that situation. But also, I did a piece over the weekend on the back of the Villa game, looking at this formation and looking at what has happened since 8 games now Newcastle have played it. Is it working? Why are they sticking with it? Why aren't they changing it? Why isn't there a centre-forward? Why is one of the centre-forwards playing as a left-winger? Why is Ryan Fraser, who's never played as a false nine as far as I'm aware in his life, suddenly playing as a false nine? And basically looking at the ins and outs of that, the statistics of how things have changed before and after it. There are some positives to the system. It has given them more balance, but really, is it the right system to help Newcastle get out of the massive hole that they've managed to get themselves into?
The double pivot, false nine, 10 formation that they're now doing. The false pivot. Is it a false pivot? Maybe it's a false pivot.
A false double nine pivot, deep lying number 7. George, what about you? Anything interesting on the horizon?
I'm working on a piece at the moment with Mickey Mellon, who is the manager of Dundee United. But probably more interesting than that, he's written a book, which is called The First 100 Days. And it's about the first 100 days is a concept we think about with American presidents usually. But he's talking about it in terms of football management and how you set the right tone when you come into a job, and also what young managers sort of need to do. It's very funny. He's had great success, Mickey Mellon, in terms of promotions, and very funny, some very funny quirky stories. But he's basically interviewed lots and lots of managers, from Solskjaer to Sean Dyche to various others, about that concept of 100 days.
Interesting stuff. So get yourself onto theathletic.com/pod on the tyne to take advantage of the special 40% discount. That's theathletic.com/pod on the tyne. Well, chaps, let's start with the Villa game. 1-1, Kieran Clarke with an own goal and Jamal Lascelles popping up in the last couple of minutes to even things up for Newcastle. Newcastle struggling to be any kind of attacking threat at the moment, aren't they? And is the system playing into that, Chris? Or is it the reason for that? Or is it something different?
Well, I refuse to accept your characterization of it as a game. The first 87 minutes certainly did not qualify as such. There was 7 minutes of moderate entertainment at the end when suddenly, yes, Villa scored and then Newcastle threw loads of bodies forward. I mean, the formation, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago I had a problem with the formation. I still have an issue with it, particularly if there aren't the first choice front three. I'm not sure if it would necessarily even be the best formation if they were available, but it just feels like a lot of square pegs in round holes. we can go over the front three to begin with. I just don't know why Ryan Fraser was playing in the middle and that Dwight Gayle was out on the left. It changed after 55 minutes, but even so, Dwight Gayle was still so deep. He was not playing as a centre-forward. He was playing that what false nine, whatever position you want to call it. And it's just bizarre.
Yeah, he was picking the ball up on the edge of his own box at times as well, and it's just not what you want, is it? The thing I thought about Dwight Gayle was it nullifies everything that Dwight Gayle gives the team. And I said this during the game on Saturday. It takes away everything that he's good at, which is being in the box, putting the shits up defenders, scoring scrappy goals, tap-ins, getting in the right place at the right time, being a bit of a poacher. You just take away all of that. And when you haven't got strikers in the first place, it just seems like a bit of a waste to me to be playing Dwight Gayle in that kind of role, George. I don't know how you felt about that. I watched it and I just thought there's no focal point. It just felt terrible.
No. I mean, when Chris says he doesn't understand why it was done. I mean, I understand why it was done, and that is to try and replicate what they were doing with Wilson and Almiron. I mean, that's the idea, isn't it? Where Wilson was playing wide and Almiron was playing through the middle. And Newcastle had a modicum of success playing that way, was certainly more successful at getting up the pitch. And so I think that's the idea, but it didn't work. It doesn't work with Gayle out there. I mean, I suppose you can make the argument, do Newcastle play well with Newcastle, you know, with Dwight Gayle up front, kind of on his own? Is that a system that is going to work in the Premier League? Mm. I don't know. But it certainly, I mean, he was
in effect. It did towards the end of last season.
Yeah, no, I agree. Absolutely. As soon as you put a centre forward into a team that didn't have a centre forward, you immediately notice the difference. I'm playing devil's advocate in the sense of, I guess it was an attempt, you know, Steve Bruce has said he's going to stick with that system. It was an attempt to stay with the system with personnel in similar positions, but it didn't work.
The thing I don't understand about that, though, is if first of all, the system, he said this after the West Brom game, he said, I don't think we had time to change between one game to another. And I could understand if they were playing 4-4-2 or 4-2-3-1, but this is a system which I bet most of those players had never played until 6 weeks ago. So it's not as if it's not, and maybe you can argue, well, stick with it because then they need to learn it and put more, but it's like, it's not that these players are programmed to play in this specific way and therefore they need to continue doing that because there wouldn't be time to shift. 4-2-3-1 they played towards the end of last season, 4-4-2 they've played at various points this year. But also, since shifting Shelvey to the deep line midfielder, the one thing that Shelvey can do that we saw in the Championship with is put Dwight Gayle in behind, put him through the middle, and yet Dwight Gayle's out wide, so Shelvey is there potentially being able to provide that. It isn't there. And if you look at the midfield, I look at the midfield and see that as a problem as well. Isaac Hayden looks like a fish out of water where he's playing at the minute. I just think he doesn't look... Since he started when this formation was to begin with, he was the deep-lying midfielder. They've shifted that round with Shelvey. And you can see Hayden doesn't know exactly what he's meant to be doing. The one thing he can do is lead the press, and he's doing that quite well. But in terms of when he gets the ball, he's passing it backward more often than not. He passed it directly out of play at one point at the weekend. I just think that it's a lot of players who look sort of uncomfortable and changing to their roles. And I understand that we said for so long this team needed an identity and that they're shifted towards this. But given all the injuries and given the fact that it's just all about wins now, I just think something like 4-2-3-1 or 4-4-2 would make more sense, just because players, I think, would be more comfortable and more reassured in what they were being asked to do rather than sort of learning on the job at the same time as needing to win games.
Wait, on about the run continues, Chris. The run continues with another point accumulated. And at this rate, Newcastle will get to safety by getting 1 point every single week. And you're saying it's all about wins, but maybe it's just all about getting a draw every single week.
To borrow your turn of phrase, George, it's more of a limp than it is a run, isn't it?
It's definitely a limp. It is definitely
absolutely
a limp. And then, I mean, Chris and I had this chat sort of straight after the game. It's like, how do you evaluate that? Well, I evaluate it. I would like to think that the sort of momentum of the last kick, which it was, you know, or header, can stay with the team.
Yeah.
That's what you hope. And that they, you know, that feeling, now that feeling in the stadium, I've said this so many times, but that feeling in the stadium with a full stadium, it would have been brilliant. Mm. You know, that would have felt like, you know, okay, fine, it was a shit game, but there's that moment at the end. Now you hope that stays with them. And, you know, Rob Lee talked about that on the commentary, and, you know, you just sort of hope that stays with them. But what came before was awful. Again, it was awful. And you're evaluating Newcastle's results, not on their own terms anymore. We've long since given up on that. We're relating to them to what happens next. And as soon as Brighton win, that becomes another bad point.
It does. You know,
it's a bad point for Newcastle. So I hope the momentum stays with them, but on its own terms, it's a bad point.
Yeah, it did feel like that after the Brighton result came through. With regards to Joe Linton as well, and we've spoken about him on a number of occasions. I didn't think he was terrible on Saturday. I didn't think he was it Saturday, Sunday? Sunday.
Friday.
God, it feels...
Every day is like Sunday, to quote Morrison.
But I thought Joe Linton was... At times, he was linking the play well and stuff like that, but I just want a bit more from him. And if he's being played in this sort of split striker role, you know, people said he's not a through-the-middle, number nine kind of player, so we're going to give him this role of playing slightly wider and try and get him on the ball a bit more. I need something else. There was another opportunity when he got through on goal and he tried to square it instead of shooting. And I was sitting pulling my hair out. And you would argue and say a player with confidence would be drilling that towards goal and potentially scoring. But he did it against what was the other game?
West Brom.
The West Brom game. He did it in the West Brom game and he did it in this game again. And he just looks flattened. The lad just looks completely flattened. And I don't know what we can do with him, but he doesn't feel like the answer. Do you know what I mean, Chris?
No, there are some things he did reasonably well around the pitch. I thought he got in behind... I mean, Tyrone Mings was awful, but I thought he got in behind him pretty well and caused him a few problems there. But it's as soon as he gets anywhere near the box, he really is. His decision-making is really, really poor. And he doesn't ever seem to make the right decision. He seems to shoot when he shouldn't or take an extra touch, as he did during the first half against Villa when he should shoot. Shearer was on commentary for... Five Live and said that he said he shouldn't take that extra touch. You've just got to finish that. Just take your chance. Yeah. And in the second half, he passes it across when he should shoot. And it was the same at Villa. He's not a natural goal scorer. The only time we've seen really him look a little bit more comfortable was when he was up in the round with Callum Wilson alongside him, taking that responsibility off him. But with no goals in this team, I think it just brings even more focus onto Joe Linton to need to score. And unfortunately, he just doesn't look like doing it at all, never mind regularly.
If he's not a natural goal scorer, what is he a natural?
Well, yeah. We're still waiting to find out, aren't we?
I don't have an answer to your question.
I don't have an answer either.
You know,
because he's not a winger and he's not a midfielder.
You know.
And he's not a striker. So what is he?
I don't want to hammer him, but I do want to hammer the people repeatedly who decided that he was the answer to what Newcastle needed, either at the time or now, with the coaching structure and with the coaching staff they've got and with the personnel that were already in the team and in the squad. I've said this before, if he cost 5 million quid, he would not be playing in the team. He wouldn't. And he has been quote unquote more effective in this system, playing higher up the pitch and wide, but he doesn't score. He doesn't look capable of shooting. And he doesn't provide enough elsewhere, you know, in the pitch. I'm not disputing that he's been effective elsewhere with a good, you know, again, quote unquote coach, you know, could be an effective player. That's not what he was brought into, though. He was brought into this team and this squad, given the number nine shirt and told to play under Steve Bruce. And it has not worked from day one, and it's still not working. And people, you know, people sort of saying he was a bit more effective, as I've just said. I mean, it's like, compared to what?
Yeah.
He is one of the biggest follies in the club's history. And it's not his fault, but... You know, absolutely shocking decision.
It's crazy, isn't it? The bookies have now got Newcastle as favourites to go down alongside Sheffield United and West Ham, and we go to Brighton with essentially a relegation six-pointer. And what do Newcastle need to do now in order to turn this round? Because if they lose this game, they are knee-deep in the shit, aren't they, George? This is real serious time now.
Well, they're already waist-deep, so, I mean, being knee-deep would suggest...
Okay, neck-deep in the shit, then, shall we say.
But, I don't want to say it's an enormous game because, I mean, it's Brighton versus Newcastle, 17th and 16th or whatever they are. It's a pathetic little, shitty little match is what it is.
Yeah.
But it will be full of tension. You know, these two teams who came up together, of course. who have kind of gone on different routes. And yeah, I'm going to go down for that because I think, you know, I kind of want to go there and see it and feel it. But it's, you know, it's just awful that it's come to this. And Steve Bruce keeps saying it, Newcastle have got to find a way, and they do. But I don't have any sort of great confidence that they will or that they can. And that's the, you know, that's the scary thing. They need to make sure they don't drop into the bottom three, because Newcastle are the ones that you just can't see, or that I can't see, clambering out of it. So having got that point last weekend, they need to follow that up and they need to shore up their position.
Absolutely. Well, chaps, let's move on. Coming up next, we've got in-depth chat with the author of a new book all about Sir Bobby Robson. Harry DeCosimo will be joining us for a chat after this.
Hello, listeners. Sorry to interrupt your show, but we've got a small favour to ask. We're currently doing a bit of a survey to find out more about you, your podcast listening habits, and the sort of adverts that are most relevant to you. If you feel like helping, please head to surveymonkey.com/r/athleticaudiouk. That's pretty catchy, so I'll say it one more time. surveymonkey.com/r/athleticaudiouk. Thank you.
So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. We are joined by a very, very special guest today, the author of a brand new book all about Sir Bobby Robson, Black and White Knight, How Sir Bobby Robson Made Newcastle United Again. We've got Harry DeCosimo with us. Harry, how are you doing?
Hi, Taylor. Thanks for having me on. I'm a really big fan of the show, so it's great to be here.
Oh, that's good to know, mate. Thanks for coming. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you. The last time I saw you, Harry, in person, me and you were playing up front at St James's Park together in a charity football game, in a performance described to me by Rob Lee as utter shit. How do you feel about that?
That was me, by the way.
That wasn't you. You were great.
I've got to clear this up because I mentioned that to Rob when I spoke to him for the book, and he said that I was rubbish. And then I turned around and showed them John Beresford's Man of the Match shirt on my wall. So clearly I wasn't that bad.
Well, the two of you might be up front again next season for Newcastle itself in the Championship. So
that's it. I'm going to get them boots out again and have another go. I think me and you could make a dynamite partnership,
absolutely.
Harry, definitely.
Absolutely.
So, Harry, the book came out yesterday.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep.
How are things going? What's the initial sort of reaction been, and how are things sort of, is there any feedback coming into you from people? Or
overwhelmingly positive so far. People have got the book and they're really excited about it. I got told by the publishers yesterday that they're reprinting it already because they're running out of copies, which was something that was really pleasant to hear. On Amazon, it's currently a bestseller as well, which I'm, you know, trying not to get too excited about, but it's all very, very positive and very, very overwhelming at this stage.
That's fantastic. And obviously the kind of the history of the book, where did the initial spark of the idea come from and the motivation for this? Was it something that's been on your mind for a long time, or is it something that just quickly came to you and you thought, I better do this?
No, I always wanted to write a book, and it was a case of trying to find the right thing. I was sitting around at the end, like middle of last season, thinking, you know, I want to do something to make this a reality. And the Bobby Robson idea hit me because for two reasons, mainly because one, it's a story that I don't think has been told enough. I think there was a gap in the market for the book. I think people have done a lot of stuff on the Kevin Keegan era. There's been a lot of, you know, knowledge on the Mike Ashley era and the Rafa Benitez era particularly. There's been a lot done on, but the Sir Bobby Robson era is sort of left alone. And I think that when you think of that as in terms of generations of people, so me, I know Chris said something. I think you were talking about the Manchester United game, the 1-0 where Schmeichel was ridiculous the other week. And Chris said that he didn't remember that game because he was only 4 years old. And basically that is effectively the reason. I'm 2 years younger than Chris. I was only two at the time. So I wanted to do it because there's a whole generation of people who don't remember the Keegan years, but still know what it's like to enjoy being a Newcastle fan. And there's a really good opportunity to do that, especially with everything that's going on at the moment. It sort of felt like a good time to bring out something positive.
And George and Chris were highly involved. Well, I'll say heavily involved. George wrote the foreword for the book and Chris provided a quote for the cover. Chris, that's a bit lazy on your part, I have to say. But no, Chris was heavily involved in the book as well with you, wasn't he? And what's it like working with these two?
Well, in fairness to Chris, he was probably the person who worked the hardest beside me because I sent him every single chapter in its rawest form. And just threw it at him and said, can you just sort this out for me? And he came back, to his credit, with lines of like really good improvements and advice within like an hour of each time that I sent it, which was incredible. And George's forward is brilliant. George was the only person I wanted for the forward. It was one of the very first things that I decided upon was getting George involved for the forward because I knew that it would be brilliant. And it's really great to be speaking to people who are obliged to say something nice about the book. So,
Yeah, it's true. We can hardly slag it off, can we? Which, I mean, it's not...
It's got your name on it, mate.
We like to be miserable on this show, but no, we can't be about this. Harry's written a beautiful, fantastic book about a very, very important part of Newcastle's history. And, you know, another thing that he's done is that he's making a donation to the Sir Bobby Robson Foundation. I've got that as my screen here because I'm a patron of the foundation. And it's very moving to me and very emotional for me because I helped Bobby write his last book and I gave my fee to his foundation and Harry is doing something very similar. And I think I find it very moving talking with my sort of foundation head on that people still relate to Bobby in the same way that, you know, he is still having that influence on people and that people are still doing sort of remarkable things in his name. I mean, that was something that always surprised him, that always kind of blew him away, that people did that with his name. But then football is also such a sort of fast-moving thing that so many people now won't have any memory of their own about, you know, Sir Bobby and his time at the club, but still they're persuaded to pull on a pair of running shoes for the first time in their lives or host a coffee morning or, you know, do a sponsored walk or whatever. And people are still doing that. And, you know, the foundation's raised over 15 million quid in his name now to, you know, find more effective ways to detect and treat cancer. And it's doing that. It's obviously been tough during the pandemic, but people are still doing that. And it's such an important cause. And Harry's made a big contribution to that, both, you know, he'll be doing that financially, but also in terms of, you know, reminding people about the foundation, which is really important.
One of the points that I really, really do like about the book is that obviously the majority of the focus is on Newcastle United and what Sir Bobby did there, but there is a decent portion which is properly dedicated to the foundation. It isn't just it's mentioned at one point, that there are the actual chapters dedicated to it and the actual effect of it. And for, I think in many ways, and for someone who didn't actually know Sir Bobby personally, but I'm sure that he would be proud of that as well, that he saw that as he said it was his last great team. That's his quote. And yeah, so that's how my involvement with Harry came. And he put a heck of a lot of effort in the book and he did send bits across. And I mean, he says that I made a lot of it. I didn't make that many edits at all. It was very good from the beginning. And one of the things I wanted to ask Harry was, going into it, you said that you were growing up during that time and you had your own memories of it. Did any of your memories change? Was there any of your perceptions changed from what you learned having spoken to people? Was there certain things about Sir Bobby that surprised you? Were there certain events which took on a different narrative to what you thought in yourself as to what had happened during that time?
I had some suspicions, Chris, with various different things. Like, for example, the way it ended, which is very sort of acrimonious and things. And I had some suspicions. So I did want to check out if the narrative and the myth that sort of a lot of myths that came up around certain things, particularly the ending, would change. And lo and behold, they did. And that's what I'm really hoping for. I'm really proud that a couple of people have come to me so far who've read the book and said, my perceptions have changed from reading the book. And that, you know, I thought I knew this and I thought I knew that. And actually it's completely changed. And that was something that was really important to me. I really wanted that, the sort of thing to come across, because that happened to me, as I say. I mean, what's really interesting is the bit between Ruud Gullit leaving and Bobby coming in is just the detail that I got on how toxic it was eye-opening. And there's a lot of that in the book and I'm really proud of it. So that was what I was really looking for, was to be able to have my perception changed and my perspective changed, and that would happen to the reader as well.
We had a conversation about this on Friday, didn't we? Carrie and I found it fascinating, you talking about the healing that had happened at Newcastle United at the time, that there was a big rift, friends who had fallen out and there was broken relationships. There was a lot of healing that needed to happen before that team could go forward. And I found it fascinating talking to you about that. And there's some real insight in that in the book, isn't there?
Yeah, that's something that I was really sort of taken aback by, just how much detail there was that I got in terms of the rift and in terms of people falling out with each other. You know, John Carver being a coach on the team, friends with the likes of Shearer, friends with Paul Ferris, who's a physio, but brought into the setup by Ruud Gullit, so he feels sort of some sort of loyalty. That's the word I was looking for, but to Ruud, and he's really caught in the middle. And then when Ruud leaves, he has to apologise to the senior players and says he'll do better. Freddie Shepherd apologising to Rob Lee was something that was pretty amazing, which sort of proves to you that everybody knew what was really wrong at the club at the time. Everyone was aware of it, you know, especially around the Sunderland game when he was making comments, and I'm sure George was in the press conferences when he was making comments, derisory comments about the derby itself and saying it wasn't the true derby. And that sort of, everyone was aware of the problems that were there, but they were just, because the manager was in place, they couldn't do anything about it. The healing really started once Ruud leaves.
It was an extraordinary time. I mean, Chris and I did something on the Gullit season. It was really about the FA Cup final at the end of the season before. But actually, the big moment was the Sunderland game. And even the Cup final was building up to the Sunderland game. But if Newcastle had won that Cup final, Shearer would almost certainly have gone at that. I mean, he would almost certainly have gone. And certainly if they'd won, if Newcastle had won the Sunderland game, he would have gone. And the, you know, from doing previous things with Paul Ferris, and he talks in his book about them sweeping the physio room for bugs. And Ferris was seen as Shearer's confidant, which he was, and sort of Derek Wright was, you know, kind of in the middle of it. And there were all these sort of rifts through the club. Now, I spoke to Gullit as well about that, and he is sort of adamant about how right he was. And he sort of will say, you look at the club now, they've still not won anything, they've still not done anything. And, you know, ask yourself why. He was trying to change the whole culture of the club. And, you know, if he'd stayed, then Shearer would have gone and it would have been a completely sort of different football club. But you're right, Harry, there were so many rifts that had to be healed. And some of those things with Shearer were so basic that Bobby did. But, you know, turning him to face goal again is the thing that he always talks about. But he'd forgotten how to be a footballer almost because his confidence was so low. You don't think of Shearer as being that kind of person, but he needed TLC. He needed Bobby's arm around his shoulder. And I mean, the other thing I really like about Harry's book is that reminder. You sort of have this golden memory of, or I certainly do, of Bobby's time at the club. And we think about the Champions League and you think about them finishing third and all those things and him, you know, his sort of wonderful turn of phrase and all that. But the first couple of years were pure graft. It was pure graft. He was a workaholic. I mean, he was an absolute workaholic. He threw himself into it. It's that old cliche about being first in and last out, but he was. He absolutely was. And he was old enough to have brought out, I'm trying to count them, they're on my shelves, I think four or even five. And the first one was called Time on the Grass. And that was about Ipswich. And, you know, for him, that was the secret of football. It was time. You know, your time, and it took Bobby time, but it was worth it.
There's an awful lot of detail in the book as well, Harry, and some of the people who you've spoke to. I mean, a lot of Newcastle fans wouldn't have heard from those voices before. What was that process like of getting in touch with people? And you spoke to Sir John Hall, and you spoke to Bobby Robson's family and stuff like that as well. What was that process like of getting in touch with those people?
A lot of the time, it was potluck. I would message them and hope that they would respond. And to be fair, Chris was crucial to helping me contact a lot of people. Liz at the foundation, who I should actually say that, you know, talking about the foundation, I went to speak to Liz at the very start before I pitched the idea, before I did any interviews. I went to speak to Liz at the Copthorne Hotel on the Quayside, and we sat and talked about it. And she said that, you know, we figured out how if they could help and how they would help and what we would do. And it was Liz who got me in touch with Mark. Mark then got me in touch with Charlie Woods. And it sort of, it was a domino effect of the I think I got all the big people I really wanted. I didn't get everybody I wanted, but I got all the key areas covered. I got family, I got, you know, the confidant and the friend in Charlie Woods. I got the board in Sir John Hall. I got the players and the coaching staff in John Carver, who was incredible in terms of taking that book and giving the detail and the colour in terms of the matches and the training ground and what happened behind the scenes, alongside, you know, Gordon Milne as well, who's the director of football. I couldn't quite believe how lucky I was. As I said, I didn't get everybody I wanted, but I got everybody I needed. I can't thank Mark Robson enough for how gracious he was. I can't really complain on who I've got. And I think that's why the book, I'm so proud of it, is the detail given by the people I spoke to.
I've got a question for George. I was watching the Sir Bobby documentary again the other day, and obviously, as someone who didn't know him, you hear the way that he speaks in public, you see his interviews, and it's unique. It's like nothing. He has an amazing turn of phrase, which I've never really seen someone speak in the way that he does before either. Is that just what he was like all the
time? Yeah, he was extraordinary. I mean, I inherited his column at the Times, which Ollie Holt had done before me, and I took it over. And I felt like this sort of enormous sense of responsibility for it, because he was someone who was very important to me. I'd gone the same school as him in Langley Park, and suddenly he was back at Newcastle and I was writing his column. But in some ways it was easy, because he knew exactly what he was doing. You know, he'd been doing that kind of stuff for years and years. He understood that he had to provide something for you. And he had those turns of phrase. So if you jotted down those turns of phrase, you would make it sound like him. You know, the idea behind doing a column is so that it sounds like that person, not that it sounds like me or somebody else. But I've sort of said this so many times now that I feel like it's sort of becoming a cliche. But when I worked with him on his book at the end, he was poorly, you know, he was dying at that point, and he looked ill. But I would go in and see him, and I would come away from being with him feeling better about myself, because that's the kind of personality he had. Now, you can understand completely how somebody would play for him, because he just had that personality. There was that sort of stardust about his personality that stayed with you once you'd gone away from him. And so he made you feel better. And I remember, so, you know, doing the book, sure, Harry will have had similar moments. You understand that it's part of his legacy, you know, what you're doing. And Harry, you're providing part of his legacy as well. And so I would come away feeling better about myself, and then I would feel guilty. I had terrible moments of guilt, because here was this dying man. I'd spent time with him and I felt better about myself. It was like I was sucking life out of him almost. But he was just that extraordinary character that made you laugh, made you smile, inspired you. I'm not a golfer. I played golf with him once at someone's stag do. And he was roped into playing golf, and so were a load of the Newcastle players. And I was on his team. And honestly, I was dog shit. It was awful. It was so embarrassing. It was a disastrous day. Anyway, we got to a par three, and I hit this shot about 20 yards along the ground. It was awful. It was embarrassing. And there were the group behind, which included a couple of colleagues, Michael Walker, our own Michael Walker from The Athletic. And Michael laughed his head off, really, really, ha, 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 fucking terrible. And Bobby just turned on his heels and had a go at him. And he said, "Don't you dare have a go at him. He's been brilliant all day. He's been absolutely brilliant. That's the first bad shot he's done. Don't you listen to them, son. It's unfair." It's like Michael was like pushed back on his heels. And, you know, I strode off down the fairway like Seve Ballesteros, thinking, I mean, I strode for about 5 yards until I got to my ball. But you had that sense of what it would be like to play for him. He could speak to, I mean, I was a lot younger than him, but he was able to speak to Bellamy. You know, I found it fascinating that his first hero was Albert Stubbins at St. James's Park. And yet he was able to deal with Bellamy. You know, he was able to deal with Bellamy and Jenness. These young kids, he found a way of communicating that spanned generations. I found that extraordinary.
Everyone still sort of agrees on how good that period was and how amazing his impact was when he came in. Harry, as far as the book's concerned itself, was there any sections of the history that were harder to write than others?
This first full season, I struggled really badly with, and I remember ringing or texting Warren Barton and saying, "Have you got anything for this?" The third chapter is actually the second season, because the second chapter is a sort of standalone chapter that I delve into to Bobby's character and purpose.
But that's it. You remember the start. You remember that incredible start. You remember the incredible game against Sheffield Wednesday. And then it's like you almost go straight from there to the Champions League. But you don't. There's not a lot glamorous about 11th and 11th. Mm. And there's not a lot of glamour. Who was his first signing? It was Kevin Gallagher, wasn't it?
Kevin Gallagher, yeah.
500 grand or something like that.
Yeah.
And there wasn't money. You know, there wasn't money.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, it was a tough slog for him at the start. And I think, but you know, again, I think that's important. You know, it's not necessarily sexy or glamorous to write about, but it wasn't just waving a magic wand. It was hard work.
But equally in there, though, also, you've also got what I was able to do was paint the picture of that. So everyone remembers Bellamy and Robert coming in, and that's when it changes. But yeah. you've got Luar Luar coming in, and you've got Amiobi getting promoted, and yeah. suddenly the squad is, and Andy O'Brien and Wayne Quinn, all these guys coming in, they're all that sort of British and Irish young core of players, which is the hallmark of Bobby's team, started in the couple of years before. You can talk about the seeds of what actually happened. But George is right, absolutely. My mind, when I was writing it, went straight from, you know, Sunderland and Chelsea that season and Bobby coming in all the way to, you know, Manchester United 4-3.
Yeah.
And suddenly, but there's a whole year in between where you've got to fill it. And I found it initially quite difficult to do.
Harry, it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you, and it's such an interesting topic, and you've obviously put your heart and soul into this book, and it's a fantastic read. People can get it on Amazon. Is there anywhere else where they can find the book?
Yeah, you can get it on Amazon, Waterstones, WH Smith, and you can, if there's enough call for it. I've been asking people to fund that donation to the foundation. I've been asking people to DM me on Twitter and come to me directly so I can sign a copy, and then they can help fund the donation to the foundation straight away. So there's all those options. If there's enough call for it, then I can make another order to the distributors and get some more copies in. But if you want it quickly and easily, then Amazon. And
I can, you know, heartily recommend it to, you know, it's a great present. And as you said at the start, it's a great reminder of when Newcastle were good and when Newcastle wanted to be good and tried to be good. Not that long ago. So, yeah, please buy it. Harry's poured his heart into it, and it's a great, great read.
Absolutely. Well, Harry, you're going to stick about with us now, and we're going to do the archive, which is a bit more of an in-depth look at that 2002-2003 Champions League season. So we'll crack on with that now. It's pretty iconic, this, isn't it? The 2002-2003 Champions League season. They come off the back of a fantastic season, and they are put into a qualifying round with Zeljezniker and astonishing 5-0 win on aggregate before we get into the real meat of this. Now, I have very different memories of this season to, I'm sure you guys will, if you know, George is a journalist who was covering it. I worked in a call centre at the time, selling holidays for a living. I didn't get to go to many games. You know, I wasn't particularly active as a fan, but I was always listening on the radio and watching the team on the TV. But I remember feeling wonderful about the club being in the Champions League. And it gives you a sense of pride of Newcastle United, which I think has been lost over the years, hasn't it? And this season was a real sort of high point for the club, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's how you would best describe it. I mean, the whole thing was, it was such a roller coaster. Obviously, it's almost like a movie in that it starts badly in the group stage. And it's not just being in the Champions League. That record that Newcastle had of losing the first three games and then still qualifying stood until Atalanta did it, I think, 2 years ago.
Yeah, no one else had done that. No one else had lost three games, the first three games.
Astonishing achievement.
It was such a difficult start. And then the end, I mean, the final game is, to talk about that game, it's so emotive all the way through. And then the Inter game is very similar. But the Juve game, people don't talk about the Juve game, even though it's a win at home against the finalists of that season as well, and the Italian champions. It doesn't quite get the same love as the final game, as the Inter game, even though it's possibly the biggest result.
It's a bigger win, isn't it? Yeah.
We were out at that point. I mean, we were effectively out.
Yeah, that is part of it as well. Yeah.
It felt like a great result, but in a hopeless cause.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's how it felt.
That's a really good point, actually.
People forget that Newcastle played 14 matches in the Champions League that season.
Yeah.
I mean, it's astonishing.
Ridiculous.
It's absolutely ridiculous. Astonishing. And, you know, there's so many sort of extraordinary moments. I mean, I was there for a lot of them, certainly there for the Feyenoord game, which was just mental. I mean, you know, again, I sort of talk, you know, as a journalist, you don't soak up a lot of what you're doing because your head's down. And so with a game like that, when you've got all that stuff happening at the end, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare that you want, obviously. Yeah. But your first reaction to something like that, and Chris will know this, and Harry will know this, is you swear, oh, fuck off. No, no. Because everything you've written is about Newcastle, Newcastle losing. And then suddenly Newcastle have won and they've qualified.
That's the change.
You almost don't remember it until later. You sort of have to take a step back, wait till your heart rate calms down, and then sort of consider it afterwards. But then there was Barcelona. And the Barcelona game being put back by 24 hours, wasn't it? Barcelona in the rain and Bobby being back there, very special moment.
There might be people listening who who, you know, who are even younger than Harry and Chris and who don't have any recollection of this whatsoever, have never had anything to do with it or seen it. Newcastle had an initial group stage of Dynamo Kiev, Feyenoord and Juventus, which in itself is quite a challenge. I mean, Juventus, like Harry says, were the Italian champions. Feyenoord, a fantastic team with some great players.
Dynamo, won the UEFA Cup the year before, I think, Feyenoord.
Yes, that's right, yeah. And Dynamo Kiev, a little bit of an unknown quality, but still had some really good players. Newcastle lost to Dynamo Kiev 2-0 in the first game. They lost 1-0 to Feyenoord at home in the next game. And then Juventus beat Newcastle 2-0 at the Stadio degli Alpi with Del Piero scoring both of the goals. And at this point, anybody who's a fan of the club would be thinking, well, that's us. That's us done. You know, that's it. It's been nice. It's been a lovely run. We've had fun, but that's all we're getting. But then, you know, fortunes turn around, don't they? And like you say, Newcastle beat Juventus 1-0 at St James's Park, and Andy Griffin scores that goal. Iconic celebrations of running around like a madman, like a fullback who's just scored a goal, because they don't do that. Against the best goalkeeper in the world at the time, yeah. Exactly. And then Newcastle go away to Kiev, and they win 2-1. And then we get that 3-2 against Feyenoord.
Opportunity for Newcastle on by Shearer. Here's Bellamy, chance for Craig Bellamy! And in stoppage time at the end of the first half, Bellamy back to fitness, back from a ban, Newcastle in front. Now, Kieran Dyer, Shearer wanting the pullback. Opportunity for Newcastle, it comes out to Viana. Well struck! It's in! It's two! Kalou. Oh, space for Bombarda! It's 2-1. Oh, Newcastle, be careful. Oh, Dyer, poor, straight to Bosvelt. And Lerling! And now Feyenoord at the centre of a Champions League second phase place in their nostrils.
I don't think I've ever seen a game of football like it. I don't think I've ever experienced anything like it watching it at home on the telly.
Shearer.
The outpour and the release of emotion when Bellamy puts that ball in at the end.
Bellamy! It's in!
It's the closest thing to euphoria I think I've ever experienced as a football fan. It was just astonishing, wasn't it? And the noise and the commentary and everything that goes with it as well. It's an amazing moment.
John Carver is so good at describing the bench that day. And what I found really funny is the way that the sort of narrative and the thing that you all think, everyone thinks they know what John Carver's like, they know what Bobby's like. Bobby's the calm, experienced one. And he becomes that at the end. And when John Carver's going mental when the goal goes in. But at 2-2, after 20 minutes after being, you know, 2-0 up, Bobby goes mental. And you see that on the highlights. He turns around to John Carver and yells in his face. And John Carver's the one left to turn around to Bobby and said, just stay calm, which is really weird. And then at the end, it all flips back into place and it you know, it goes, everyone goes mental. And you get the description of going back to the hotel for beers. Yeah. And Bobby slips off and has a nice champagne in his room. That sort of is what you would expect. But that whole thing, that final game is such an iconic game, not just because of what needed to happen. And Shay Given talks about wanting to prove to a lot of people that they could do it, because even at that stage, they'd kind of felt like they'd been written off. Having beaten Juve and beaten Dino Kiev, they still didn't feel like they were getting the respect they deserved. And it was that moment that people went, okay.
Yeah.
Of course, the second group phase starts as the first one.
And
square one a little bit. But at that moment, it was like, I think John Carver says, it's like winning the Champions League.
But of course, Newcastle go through into what was dubbed the group of death with Internacional, Barcelona and Bayer Leverkusen. And again, we start off with two defeats. What I will say, though, is a wonderful moment where Shola Ramiobi levels things up at the Nou Camp with a goal. And one of those moments that I still watch on YouTube every so often just to think, yeah, we did that. We scored at the Nou Camp. Yeah. Amazing, amazing stuff. And then we have 2-3-1 victories over Bayer Leverkusen where things turn around. And we start to look like we could actually do something in this group. And it's always the case for Newcastle. It's the hope that kills you. You know, you have two bad results, you have two good results, and you start to believe. And that's the danger, isn't it, Chris? It's like you suddenly feel, oh, actually, we could do something here. I'm getting fizzy pants.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned those. So at that point, the Champions League, and I think it was only for a couple of seasons, had two group stages. So that's why Newcastle played the 14 games, because they had the two qualifiers, then they had six group stage games. Then you go from that into another group stage. And those teams that you mentioned there, I mean, they're European heavyweights.
Oh,
the first
group
is hard enough. The second one is absolutely massive. And what I find astonishing is you look back at the period, and I think this almost gets overlooked. It's like, oh, Newcastle won the Champions League and they got through the second group stage. But they're also competing for the league title. They are really competing for the league title. And you think about it now, and you think about the Mike Ashley era, and, oh, we can't go for the FA Cup because there's too many games and all this sort of stuff, and we can't compete that.
Yeah.
Newcastle United were both going for the league title and managed to navigate 14 games in the Champions League to get through to the second group stage. That is an astonishing achievement. He had a very good squad, Robson Lee built, but it wasn't massive.
Yeah.
He still didn't have the riches that some of the best clubs did. And yet to navigate that is, I just find astonishing.
He didn't sign a player for over £10 million in his entire reign.
That's amazing, isn't it?
And I think I even mentioned that against Man United, when they finished fourth, Man United was 6 points better off, having spent £50 million on Van Nistelrooy and Veron. And if you put that into context, and you put the, you know, with all due respect to the likes, and Steve Caldwell is so honest about this. Steve Caldwell, Andy Griffin, Andy O'Brien, they're not going to go and move to Arsenal if they leave Newcastle or Manchester and play in the Champions League again. And yet, Bobby inspired them to do that while also, as Chris points out, battling for the league title, which is crazy. It's incredible.
Slight trivial point. My highlight from going to Bayer Leverkusen, I can't remember anything about the match or anything about the stadium. I can't remember anything, but I do remember going to the club shop and coming back with a signed photo of Ralph Minge, who was a coach at Bayer Leverkusen at the time. And that is my favourite ever piece of sporting memorabilia, which I still have. It's faded now, so you can't see the signature anymore, sadly, but it's still on my fridge. It's on my fridge. Ralph Minge. I've just looked up. He's currently works as sporting director of Dynamo Dresden.
Of course he does. Still in the game. One of my favourite things, which I didn't know about until Friday when I had a chat with Harry on the phone, is the Barcelona game, the one that was rained off initially, and then they played the game 24 hours later. Now, there was a bit of talk about whether the game was going to be put back a day or whether it was going to be put back a week. And there was an awful lot of excitement in the Newcastle camp, as Harry told me. They found out that Shakira was staying in the same hotel as the Newcastle team. And a few of the lads had wanted to try and get into the party she was having on the rooftop the day after the cancelled game. Now, if the game had been put back a week, then a number of the players could have got in there. And I think we've avoided some kind of sliding doors moment here where Gerard Piqué could have potentially been replaced by Kieran Dyer or Stephen Caldwell even. I just think it's a wonderful story, Harry. And you were saying Stephen Caldwell told me that story and it just made you laugh out loud. It was great.
I had to get him to repeat it and like verify it like again. I didn't think I'd heard him correctly first time. And I thought, as soon as you said it, like, even if it makes no contextual sense, that's going right in the middle of the book because it's just, it's so funny and it's so, without naming names, you can imagine how gutted certain players of that team would have been when they find out that, oh, we have to go and play Barcelona tomorrow instead of going upstairs for a party with Shakira. I couldn't wait to be able to talk about it because it's just, I just can't believe that it's never, no one's ever said that before. It's just, but it's almost so fitting that, really, it's one of those things that isn't really that important to the wider story, but it just makes it tick for me, that sort of thing. Those are the sorts of stories that you go in, as George and Chris will know, when you go into an interview, you want someone to tell you something like that. And when they do, it's just like gold.
Lucky that my breasts are small and humble, so you don't confuse them with mountains. Which is one of the great lyrics,
It's a proper what-if moment for me, that. I mean, I imagine, you know, the MTV Video Music Awards. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Shakira Amiobi. Just imagine. It would be astonishing, wouldn't it? It was just brilliant. Oh, anyway. So, yeah, I mean, ultimately, Newcastle were knocked out in the end. We drew 2-2 with Inter. Again, a pretty iconic game and a game that a lot of Newcastle fans who travelled away at the time hold up as being one of their favourite ever away trips. Alan Shearer with two goals, of course, and the astonishing atmosphere inside the San Siro as well. Again, it's one of those moments of pride that I had in my club at the time. It was, I'd seen the San Siro on TV a number of times, and I used to watch Football Italia on Channel 4 when I was a kid on a Sunday afternoon and loved that show and loved Italian football. And then to see my team playing in that great stadium was a real moment of pride for me as well. And of course, Barcelona beat Newcastle United 2-0 at home in the last game of the group stage. And they go out, but filled with pride. And they made a real good effort of it and a real good fist. And I think it's still an astonishing time period in the club's history.
If I get my timings right, I was spent most of the Milan trip being furious because Sunderland appointed Howard Wilkinson as manager. I think, if I'm right, we were all stuck in our rooms because we were obviously all North East writers there. If I've got my timing right. So that spoilt Milan. Ruined.
Well, Harry, listen, thank you so much for coming on and talking about the book with us and going through those old memories of the Champions League season. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on, mate, honestly, and stay in touch and come back and tell us how the book's getting on. And, you know, if you're going to write any more, good luck with everything. I hope it goes brilliantly for you. And thanks a lot for coming on. It's been great fun.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it. I do listen to all the episodes. So I'm aware of how ragey it's going to get for George with the quiz in about 5 minutes. This is the best thing about writing the book, is coming on and talking about Bobby and doing this. It's been fantastic, so thank you.
As you can see, it's a lovely day. So for me, it's a great day to be announced as the new manager of Newcastle United Football Club. I'm very proud of that, and I'm absolutely thrilled. It's a great challenge. I'm up for it. I'm not afraid of it. And I'm going to really enjoy working in the North East again. We have to bring about a set of results that the board and the fans deserve.
Right then, boys, it's quiz time. And I just wanted, before we start this, I need to register for the record. Can the record show that I am complaining about the fact that I have to do a Bobby Robson-themed quiz against the man who literally wrote the book on Sir Bobby Robson? I want the record to show I'm putting... And I know we make a joke about George every week and how he can't remember anything and he wouldn't know his own birthday unless it was written down for him. But this is bullshit, by the way. I'm saying this now. So if I lose this, heavily.
Sure. I'm just taking a note in the record here.
I can see that. That's good. Right. If I lose this heavily, I don't want any flack for this. All right. Absolutely ridiculous.
Your record is noted.
Absolutely ridiculous. How are then, Chris?
Right. Well, anyway, for the pub this week is the Newcastle Arms. Just down from St. James's.
Wonderful stuff.
Mm-hmm. Often see on match day, people stood outside.
Been drunk in there many times over the years.
Yes.
Always has good,
does,
good beer.
Does have good beer. So, some of my earliest memories of going to football was sort of stood outside there, not drinking. Not, I was only like 6 years old.
Come on, Chris, be honest. Half a pint of mild.
But we stood outside the Newcastle Arms. You know, it's quite small inside. So, you know, the quiz is, and it's quiz time, but the quiz is going to happen both inside and outside. It's nice.
I don't think you can drink outside the Newcastle Arms because you're on that main street.
You can definitely stand outside. I've stood outside. I don't know if you can drink outside. But
yes, but you were six, Chris. What were you doing outside the Newcastle Arms at the age of six anyway?
I was just let loose, really. But anyway, so we're at the Newcastle Arms, regardless of whether we're inside or outside. We're having a nice pint.
Well, I want to be inside so I can drink
you're
alcohol.
Outside, you're having it.
Right. Can you be outside and me be inside? I'm happy with that.
Right, so I'm outside, you're inside, but I am the quiz master. And you've already buggered up the first round of my quiz because one of the questions was going to be who was the first permanent sign to Bobby Robson made. So we've scrapped the first round.
Oh, I would have got that.
We've scrapped the first round. First round is gone. So second round is scorers.
Right, what?
So I'm going to go first with George.
Ugh.
So who scored the first goal of the Sir Bobby Robson era?
It was at
first
Chelsea,
Newcastle
wasn't
goal.
It?
No, first Newcastle goal, yeah.
Oh, first Newcastle goal. Oh, okay, right. So they lost at Chelsea. I don't know. I'm going to say Shearer, but I don't know.
Taylor, do you know?
Gary Speed?
No, he was a guest on the podcast, I believe.
Aaron Hughes.
Previously. Aaron Hughes.
Oh, right, okay.
Did he?
Yes, he scored the first nil. He scored because he remembered he shouldn't have been there, but he just ran at the box and scored header. So that was the first 8-0 victory over Sheffield United on the 17th, on September 19th, 1999. So Taylor, which player scored the final goal of the Sir Bobby Robson era? Newcastle player again. Which Newcastle player scored the final goal of the Sir Bobby Robson era?
Oh, God. Craig Bellamy?
Incorrect. George?
I just always say Alan Shearer because it's bound to be right eventually.
So it was a 4-2 defeat away at Aston Villa on August the 28th, 2004. It was Andy O'Brien.
piss off, Chris.
So it's 0-0 going into the penalties round. And this is sort of copied from George's, but it is actually a literal penalties round. So on August the 27th, 2003, Newcastle lost 1-0 at home to Partizan Belgrade in the Champions League third qualifying round, second leg. They eventually lost on penalties. Between you, I'd like to alternate you to alternate as to who the penalty takers for Newcastle were. Regardless of whether they missed or scored, I don't really care, but just I don't need them any particular order, but I want the first to give me an incorrect answer loses, unless obviously you both do at the same time. So there were seven in total, seven penalty takers. Taylor, you go first.
Penalty takers.
Seven in total for both misses and scorers.
Alan Shearer would have to be one, wouldn't he?
Alan Shearer, yes, took the first penalty, missed it.
Missed it, yeah. That was my only answer. As I say, I answer Alan Shearer to everything. I'd say Alan Shearer again. See what would happen if I do that. Just get it wrong, wouldn't I? Oh, Christ on a bike. I was there. Doesn't make any difference. Absolutely blank in my own head. Rob Lee.
Incorrect. So, I mean, Taylor's already won, but I'll let Taylor see if he can get any more.
Kieran Dyer.
I hate this.
Kieran Dyer missed the second penalty. The first three were missed. The third miss. Do you know that?
No, but I'll say Lauren Robert.
No, he didn't take one. Taylor?
I mean, this is...
Shawler. Shawler must have scored.
Shawler scored. Yeah, so he scored the first penalty. That was the fourth penalty. So the third miss was Jonathan Woodgate.
Wow. All right.
I was going to say that.
Well, you didn't, did you, George?
No, I wasn't going to say that.
Do you know the other two goal scorers?
Can we speed?
Did Luoluwa take one?
Luoluwa scored the second.
Right. God. Was Lee Bowyer there at the time?
No, it wasn't Lee Bowyer. So the third was Jermaine Genus got the other one. And the final miss was also Aaron Hughes. So Newcastle missed their first three penalties, but then still managed to get to sudden death and then still lost, having won the first leg as well, 1-0 away.
All right.
That was sort of the travesty of that era, the Partizan Belgrade. It was a bizarre.
I think from now on, I should only ask questions in the quiz because it's pointless me answering them. It's absolutely pointless.
Yes, you have won, but I'm going to quickly do the tiebreaker anyway. So not that it that matters, but...
I didn't even know I'd won. Sorry, managed... Chris. Is that it? I didn't know I'd won.
Yes, you've won. You've won again. George has lost again. So Bobby Robson managed 255 games across all competitions as Newcastle manager. How many of them did he win?
Oh, God.
Of course, it's two wins. So 255 games in all competitions. George can answer first or second. He can pick. It's up to him.
I'll go first. I'm going to say 193.
How many games was it, Chris?
255.
I think he won 164.
I mean, they're quite high win ratios you've gone for there. George in particular, which is like almost a 4-5 win ratio.
I was going to say, Chris, before you tell me this,
93.
I thought you said 193. You said 93.
No, 93.
Right. I based mine off what you said, and I thought you said 193 as well. I was originally going to say 127.
No, 93.
Chris, this is ridiculous.
So I've gone for a high 93. Third, as it were.
So, can I change my answer, Chris?
Fuck no. Just answer, just give us the answer.
So the answer is 119. So you had a 46.7% win ratio. You had 64 defeats and 64 draws and 72 defeats. But George,
I won that.
George won that, but that's completely irrelevant. So Taylor, yes, you win the Sir Bobby Robson quiz. Well done.
Yeah, Taylor. Stitch that coping.
I hate this quiz.
Well, there we go, chaps. That's another episode of Pod on the Tyne, all done and dusted. It's been good fun. I really enjoyed the chat with Harry. And obviously, get yourself on the website and check out that latest 40% offer on subscriptions. We'll be back next week. Hopefully, Newcastle will pick some points up against Brighton and we'll have a little bit of positivity going. But until then... thanks very much. Take care of yourselves. Look after yourselves, ladies and gents, and we will speak to you very, very soon. Cheers.
The Athletic.